ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We've seen very encouraging results with the introduction of the youth curfew. Even after it has ended, the police, the Department of Education, Territory Families and Health and other service providers will continue to work together much closer than they have been doing before the youth curfew.
Alice Springs youth curfew extended for another week, and you'll meet a Victorian man whose life has changed after he switched from opiates to medicinal cannabis.
I was on so much OxyContin at one stage I couldn't string two thoughts together. So rather than have the opiates, I'm able to take the cannabis oil.
But there are concerns that cheap, poorly regulated imported product is flooding the market, threatening the locally grown industry and potentially putting lives at risk. I'm Michelle Stanley and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Garryarra Country in the Pilbara town of Port Hedland. Beginning today in Alice Springs, where the Northern Territory government has extended a youth curfew until next Tuesday, coinciding with the end of school holidays. The curfew bans people under the age of 18 from entering the town centre between 6pm and 6am without a valid reason. It was brought in on the 27th of March in response to unrest and antisocial behaviour in the town and was due to end at 6 tomorrow morning. But following advice from an emergency management council meeting held on Monday, the decision has been made to extend the curfew. Thomas Morgan is the ABC's Northern Territory political reporter and he is in Alice Springs. Tom, the NT Chief Minister has just announced this extension. What prompted the decision?
Yeah, well, it's been largely because of community feedback and feedback from police that it's been relatively well received, this curfew, which basically means that anyone under the age of 18 who's out on the streets of the Alice Springs CBD between 6pm and 6am without a lawful reason can be, I guess, talked to by police, can be then either taken home or taken to a safe place. That, of course, was brought in on March 27th following the very serious scenes which we saw on the streets of Alice Springs. And that was all attributed back to the death of an 18-year-old teenager in a car crash early in March. Now, this extension will take Alice Springs through the school holidays until next Tuesday. At that point, it is expected that the curfew will lift. Now, the Chief Minister, Eva Lawler, was speaking in Darwin, where she said that the curfew had played a really important role in bringing down some of the crime and antisocial behaviour that we'd been seeing in Alice Springs.
The conversations on the ground from Alice Springs residents is this has been the best thing that's happened to Alice Springs. It really was a circuit breaker. People are feeling so much safer, so much more comfortable. But then from Territory Families, talking to the CEO, Emma White, it has been that some of those young people that have been picked up on the street, when they've taken them home, the families are saying, we want help around our kids. And so The anecdotal comments have been great. Also, the data that the police have around the numbers, it started at 60, it dropped down to about 40. I think it went up a little bit over the weekend. But it's been great to see that those numbers have reduced, that there's about 30 kids on average. Maybe there's a small group that continuously are on the street, but then we're putting in services around that. So to me, the curfew has been a great success.
And the Chief Minister at that press conference did add as well that there'd been no arrests associated with this curfew, police instead opting to take more of an educational approach and take youths back to safe places, whether it be with their family or to accommodation elsewhere in Alice Springs.
So it is relatively fresh, this information, but how has the announcement landed with the Alice Springs community?
Well, before the decision to extend this curfew today, yesterday there were a whole bunch of meetings with members of the local community, including Indigenous organisations, and many of them were and have been quite full of praise, really, for the decision to call this curfew, saying that the curfew has performed the role of a circuit breaker in Alice Springs and helped really police and the various different other organisations and government departments to get on top of this situation. And the Chief Minister acknowledged that at a press conference today, saying that the different departments of the Northern Territory government, such as Territory Families, were now working more in unison to try and provide kids who are out on the street support if they, for instance, come from a difficult home. So before this announcement that this curfew would be extended, the rumours that there would be an extension were being met with quite some enthusiasm. Now, whether or not the enthusiasm lasts forever is another question, and also whether or not this curfew actually does go to the base root issues as to what is causing some of the antisocial behaviour in Alice Springs is the next question that I think a lot of people will be asking.
On Australia Wide, Northern Territory political reporter Thomas Morgan is with you from Alice Springs, where the community is responding to this extension of the youth curfew. It will be extended until 6 o'clock next Tuesday morning, banning young people entering the town centre from 6 till 6 without a valid reason. So, Tom, the curfew will continue for another 6 days, but then what? What's the government's plan after that?
Well, we don't really have much indication of what they're planning to do, except for the fact that, as I mentioned just a few moments ago, that the Chief Minister said that a lot of these government departments are now working more in unison to respond to situations where they may find children on the street. And she said that that is potentially something that can be looked at moving forward. But beyond that, I do think that the government will need to come out again and potentially unveil even further measures. It's really an interesting situation where, you know, the average person on the street that you might talk to might be in favour of the curfew lasting forever, but given that 58 officers had to be brought in from other parts of the territory from the Northern Territory Police Force's rostering to come and staff this curfew, there is a question of the sustainability of this curfew. The opposition, for instance, are calling here in the Northern Territory for the curfew to last for 2 months, but I think the government will be probably, you know, listening to police who might have issues around how they're actually going to be able to sustain that level of staffing for that amount of time.
Yeah, you mentioned resources there, and also in this press conference with the Chief Minister this afternoon, the findings of an independent review into the Northern Territory Police Force were unveiled. What were the main takeaways from that?
Yeah, this review was handled by the former head of the police union here in the Northern Territory, the NTPA, Vince Kelly, and he basically handed down 18 recommendations. Among them were greater support for the mental health of officers. That was followed a string of mental health issues that were rose to the fore of the NT Police Service in 2022. A couple of major recommendations included transferring a whole bunch of responsibilities that police are currently, I guess, burdened with in terms of policing bottle shops across to the liquor holders, to the actual license holders of those liquor stores. Now, that recommendation has been rejected by the government. So too has a recommendation to get rid of private security firms who do some policing around the Darwin CBD and other problem parts of Darwin and here in Alice Springs as well. That recommendation also rejected. But the Police Minister, Brent Potter, did say that 15 of those 18 recommendations in this fairly wide-ranging and much-anticipated review will be adopted by the government, and he said that that would come at a significant cost to the Northern Territory government.
Building up the Northern Territory Police Force will require a lot of hard work. Importantly, we've accepted the vast majority of the recommendations of this review. The recommendations that have not been accepted are due to the government's determination and commitment to improving community safety across the territory. We won't be getting rid of pallies, and we believe there is a role for private security to play in keeping parts of the territory safe.
A lot more to come from Alice Springs, no doubt. Thomas Morgan, thank you for your time on Australia Wide today.
Thanks, Michelle.
ABC Australia Wide.
This is our history. This is Australia's history as much as anything.
On ABC Radio.
Michelle Stanley with you. It's been nearly 8 years since cannabis was legalised in Australia for medicinal reasons. It's allowed doctors to prescribe cannabis to patients to treat a range of pain and health concerns. As the number of patients accessing medicinal cannabis has grown, so too has the industry supplying it. Now there are concerns that cheap, poorly regulated imported product is flooding the market, threatening the locally grown industry and potentially putting lives at risk. Central Victorian reporter Tyrone Dalton has been taking a look at this issue. Tyrone, how many Australians are prescribed medicinal cannabis by their doctors?
So here's where the juxtaposition is, and the grey area, I guess, that sits within the medicinal cannabis use in Australia is there's 140,000 people prescribed medicinal cannabis. But then if we look at a survey from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare last year, 700,000 people are telling them that they're using medicinal cannabis to treat chronic pain and anxiety conditions. So there's a big gap there around who is taking medicinal cannabis and who is being prescribed it.
Wow, that's a huge difference. So the people that say they are using medicinal cannabis, what are they using it for? How are they taking it? How is it sort of used in the community?
So I guess you'd start from cannabis. It's the flower, and that's grown and cultivated here and overseas. That becomes, you know, a product that, you know, it's cut, you know, for the little green bits off of it. If you want to roll it and use it, say, in the way that someone would use a cigarette, or you can have it put into a cannabis oil. And that's typically what most people use it for, how most people use it. So Terry Russell lives here in Victoria. He has a spinal injury, degenerative discs that continue to deteriorate over the years. And so he's been through quite a number of treatments. He has quite bad back pain and leg pain, mainly through nerves. So like really bad sciatica. So he was looking for something that would give him the pain relief, but wasn't OxyContin. So he's really struggled to live on that. And then he tried cannabis oil after being recommended it by his doctor, and he took that up, and he's been on it for about 12 months now, and he says it's given him his quality of life back because he has that cognitive function but also the pain relief. He's not pain free, so he needs to be able to find some way to manage that pain like another 140,000 odd Australians.
I've had back problems for over 20 years. I had to retire when I was 46 years of age, and I've continued to have disc deterioration. I've had lots of different treatments to try and manage the pain. I was on so much OxyContin at one stage I couldn't string two thoughts together, and I had to ask my spinal cord specialist, Ken, you can get me off this, I can't function. I found it really good. I don't get a feeling of being stoned, or I don't get any cognitive impairment with it, but it certainly relaxes, and I find it's really good for the nerve pain.
So the cannabis that is being used by people like Terry Russell, where is it coming from? Is it grown locally in Australia, or is it being imported?
Both. So the stats that we have is that 80% of the medicinal cannabis market at the moment is imported cannabis. And that's what's really drew the ire of the medicinal cannabis industry here in Australia. So we spoke to several medicinal cannabis growers here. They're saying that they've got 30% extra running costs because of the red tape that they have to adhere to and the rules that they have to abide by in grading and quality control and making sure that the amount of cannabis comes in is accounted for when it comes out. So that comes down to the Office of Drug Control and what they require. The imported cannabis doesn't have that same regulation. The Therapeutics Goods Administration, who is responsible for regulating medicinal cannabis in Australia, doesn't require importers to test that cannabis before sending it to market. It assumes that that was already done overseas where the product originated from. So if there's no requirement for the importer to test that, and if it's not being tested overseas and there's no guarantee of that, then it could essentially be sent to market without having any quality control through that process. That's not to say that all importers are doing that. We've spoken to some importers that are saying we're testing our cannabis, but if the rule isn't there, then it's a great unknown to be able to go, we're sending this product out and we're not sure if it's got the right amount of cannabis in it or if it meets Australian standards.
So how are some of the Australian growers reacting to that gap in the system?
Well, they're saying, again, those 30% extra running costs is crippling them, really. You know, they want a sustainable and viable industry here. If you look at Can Group in the northwest of Victoria, in the regional city of Mildura, they are suspended from trading on the Australian Stock Exchange. That was an announcement made last month. The CEO is stepping down from that role. He finishes in June because of where things are at now. They set up a $170 million facility in the northwest of Victoria to grow medicinal cannabis, and was one of Australia's biggest cannabis growers. Like other growers, they're saying that a lack of government regulation is the problem. They don't want their regulation to be reduced. They just want to operate on an even playing field. They want medicinal cannabis to be treated like a medicine, like a pharmaceutical that has all the controls and the checks and balances in a market that is guaranteeing patient safety at the end of it. We spoke to Nan Marie Scurie. She is the managing director of ECS Botanics in Kerrang in northern Victoria. They grow medicinal cannabis there, and she explains how the goods manufacturing practice, that GMP standard that they have to adhere to, is creating an uneven playing field. But as much as she wants it to remain, she also wants importers to have to abide by the same rules.
The Australian regulator made a decision to allow flower to be packed by contract manufacturer. Contract manufacturer is therefore supposed to audit the suppliers and make sure that they're produced in a hygienic and safe environment. The problem is there's 700 products in the market at the moment. There's over 100 suppliers. Most of that product is coming from all over the world. And there's just no way that those GMP packers have the resources or even probably not the know-how in how to audit a supplier in a foreign country. The concern for us is the regulator said they would make sure that they'd monitor the industry, that they would check that the products did meet specification. But what actually happened is they haven't tested any product, and I don't believe they've checked on any of the packers to make sure they're following the regulations.
On Australia Wide, Tyron Dalton is with you and he's talking through the impact that imported medicinal cannabis is having on the Australian industry. Tyron, have there been problems linked to people who have taken medicinal cannabis that might not meet these quality standards?
So there's, when we looked into this part, there was only 6 adverse reactions that were notified to the TGA, the Therapeutics Goods Administration, of people having that adverse reaction. So some of the symptoms that they had from taking this medicinal cannabis was psychosis, was nerve damage, was incontinence. But there was only those 6 notifications. 2 of those we could see was from imported cannabis. The other ones weren't a listed product. So the name of the product or the origin of that product wasn't clear from the data that we could see. Patient advocates, you know, are saying about those reactions is it is helping more people than what it may be having an adverse reaction or a bad effect to.
So whose responsibility is it then to make sure that the imported product is meeting the same high quality standards as the locally grown medicinal cannabis?
Well, that would come down to the TGA, and so the Therapeutics Goods Administration. They told us they haven't tested any imported cannabis in the past 12 months, which is concerning. They also told an audience at a convention in Melbourne last month that more so it wasn't its job to do so, that it didn't want to see the regulation tied to activities. From that, we look at the Medicinal Cannabis Growers Association, who do want the TGA to play a bigger role in that. But the TGA says it's not resourced to do so. And that's probably going to require some government intervention, some legislation that sets up the framework so that the TGA can respond in the way that it would need to if it's to really assess and routinely test the imported cannabis coming into Australia.
Yeah, it's a really complex issue, Tyron Dalton. Thanks so much for covering it on Australia Wide today.
Thanks, Michelle.
ABC Australia Wide.
If you listen really, really hard to the wind that's blowing, you can hear the voices and there's a peace come over you.
On ABC Radio.
Sugarcane is one of the longest running industries in colonial Australia, but in recent times it's seen major upheavals. In the past 4 years, 3 mills have shut up shop, but there are hopes a scientific breakthrough could halt this downward trajectory and even give it a new purpose. Beyond the production of raw sugar, sugarcane is incredibly versatile, and with the help of science, there's the potential that it could be used to produce greener fuel alternatives. But growers say they need better government policy to make sure the renewable fuel is made in Australia. Queensland reporter Megan Hughes looked into the issue.
Sugar is a pantry staple in most households, however you use it, for baking or even in your cuppa. It's a large industry in Australia based out of Queensland and northern New South Wales, worth $2.5 billion, but it's in upheaval. after three mill closures in 4 years, with Mossman Mill in far north Queensland the latest to shut its doors. Now there's hope a research breakthrough could offer the diversification the industry needs. Scientists have mapped the crop's genome, going right into the DNA and finding out which genes produce certain traits. Report co-author Professor Robert Henry from the University of Queensland explains.
We now will be able to identify the genes that control the sugar content or the disease resistance or other attributes. So we'll be able to enhance those characteristics by breeding, because we'll have the ability to work with the genetics of those sorts of traits.
It may sound arbitrary, but it gives the industry a tool to produce better sugarcane, and sugarcane that can be grown for uses other than raw sugar. Sugarcane was brought to Australia on the first fleet in 1788, and until now it's been grown basically just to produce raw sugar. But the crop is incredibly versatile, and it can be used to make biofuels, bioplastics, perfume, and even sustainable fabrics. The principal investigator of the study is CSIRO research scientist Dr. Karen Aitken.
I've been working on sugarcane for about the last 20 years, and sugarcane is the last of the big crop plants that to be sequenced. And the reason for that is because sugarcane has a very complicated genome. It has over 100 chromosomes. And my role in it was, I was really interested in getting the genome because it's such a valuable resource for everyone. And I had to get funding, and I found funding was available through the US Department of Energy Community Sequencing Program. And to get the funding, you need to show that the research communities around the world are interested in using the genome sequence.
Now the research is publicly available for anyone internationally to use. Australia's industry is already starting on the back foot. Brazil is the largest sugar producer in the world, and a large portion of their crop is used to produce ethanol to fuel their cars. Now, when growers choose which varieties of sugarcane to plant, an important quality is how much sugar the plant can yield. But when growing for other things, like biofuel production, they need a crop that produces a large biomass, which is the organic material of the plant that can be turned into fuel. And producing a large biomass means potential for a biofuel industry, as Dr. Aitken explains.
We've all heard about the push for biofuel and sustainable aviation fuel. And being able to generate that from biomass and, you know, plant biomass, and in this case, sugarcane biomass, means that we are all contributing to a greener planet.
Professor Henry says being able to manufacture aviation fuel from a crop like sugarcane could significantly contribute to achieving Australia's net zero emissions target by 2050.
This seems to be the only option, if you like. If we're going to have jet fuel for those long-haul flights, it's going to have to come from a plant source. It's got to be an agricultural product. There's no other option if we don't want to dig it up out of the ground. The 2050 target that the world sort of set itself says that we're going to really be putting in a big effort to achieve these things on that sort of time frame. I'm optimistic that in the next 5 years or so, we'll see at the research level these things being achieved, and maybe by 2030 we'll be that sort of time we'll start to see very significant commercial adoption.
And there is demand for this. Aviation lobby group Airlines for Australia and New Zealand has developed a roadmap for the industry to reach net zero by 2050, which includes using sustainable fuel from products like sugarcane. Back in the paddock, it's been a slow process to build a biofuel industry from the ground up. Chief Executive Officer of Queensland Cane Growers Dan Galligan says they've been doing their own work, but now they need government policy change.
The Australian government really needs to get their skates on to look at what policy initiatives they can implement to increase the production volumes out of Australia, to encourage airlines to buy Australian fuel, to encourage new investment in biorefineries in Australian fuel, so that there's confidence in that investment. It's not a lack of money. That's the big issue. It's not money. There is plenty of money globally around development of bioenergy, but it is encouragement from governments that we're seeing happening in other countries, not happening in Australia, to develop the policies that will increase the volume so that the price of the production of the fuel comes down.
A spokesperson for the Department of Climate Change and Energy says the Australian government is committed to supporting the biofuel industry in Australia, and they're developing a fuel quality standard to enable the supply of renewable diesel in Australia. And also, $30 million has been made available for grants under the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Funding Initiative. That story from Megan Hughes, and thanks to Abby Holter for additional reporting. And that's Australia Wide for this Tuesday. Remember, you can podcast the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. I'm Michelle Stanley. I'll catch you next time.
ABC Listen.